Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Jonathan Portis. I'm Professor of Economics and Public Policy at King's College London, and also a Senior Fellow of UK in a Changing Europe.
UK in a changing Europe. Europe in a changing UK, perhaps, who
Well,
knows?
indeed. I mean, it's an odd name. It's a research network that was originally set up to in the run-up to the Brexit referendum to examine from a academic and research point of view to try and inform the public about what research said about various issues relating to Brexit in the EU without taking a stance one way or the other. Since then, of course, we've had Brexit took rather longer than we expected, so we spent a number of years continuing to try and inform the debate until Brexit finally happened, and now we're you sort of trying to look at both the impacts of Brexit, but also the UK's post-Brexit relationship with Europe and indeed in the world as a whole.
I hope we'll get onto that a bit later. Prof. Jonathan, I'd like to start by asking you what's currently dynamizing, retarding, animating, preoccupying you?
My research has for a very, very long time now focused on immigration, especially immigration to the UK. We're really in a quite extraordinary period where after Brexit and the pandemic, we've seen a very, very sharp rise in immigration to the UK to really at levels which are really historically unprecedented. Perhaps 2 million people have moved here over the last couple of years. Of course, some have left at the same time, but nonetheless, that is a very, very large number by historical standards. So the UK, for example, is now more a country of immigration than the United States. If you look at the proportion of people living here now who were not born in this country, it's greater than the US. That's quite a shift for us. Now some of those, the reason that's happened is temporary and it will recede. But nonetheless, how that's going to play out economically, socially, and politically in the UK is a focus of my research. And then more broadly, of course, this is not something which well the UK is a I'm lucky enough focusing on the UK. The UK is a particularly interesting, unusual, and fascinating case here from all sorts of perspectives. But nonetheless, this is hardly something which is happening just in the UK. Of course, immigration is a big economic, social, and political issue in pretty much every advanced economy, certainly most European countries, certainly the US, and even in Japan, because the broader issues and pressures and drivers are to some extent common in advanced economies. While, as I say, my own sort of stuff that I publish in academic senses is very much US fo UK focused. Nonetheless, I'm the broader question of how this is going to shape you European and other advanced economies over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years is something that I think is absolutely fascinating.
One of the ironies, Jonathan, at the moment is that here in Spain, I can watch most Premier League Association football matches, and I keep seeing banner signs that say, visit Rwanda. This at the moment when the UK government has spent hundreds of millions of pounds in money to the Rwandan government to set up what it fervently hopes will be a scheme for basically expelling asylum seekers and other people that it calls illegal immigrants. But that seems to me to spell out the sort of very double-sided nature of this debate. On the one hand, you have this notion of, as you were saying, wealthy countries increasingly becoming places for immigration, as so many people seek a better life be that in terms of their personal safety or their economic well-being. At the same time as we're seeing the growth in economies in the global south to levels that many development economists had never imagined. So you can get visit Rwanda at the same time as you can have Rwanda being, a destination for unwanted migrant arrivals in the imaginary, at least, of the Conservative Party.
Yes, so there are some really difficult political contradictions here. And again, this is true, it is certainly the case in the UK, but also elsewhere in Europe, where you have quite strong economic pressures for migration, both on the demand side and the supply side. There's demographics mean that. And particularly some, in some sectors like health and care, countries actually want, whether they say it or not, higher levels of migration. At the same time, their publics are not, perhaps unreasonably, not happy about the idea of large-scale irregular or illegal migration. For both for self-interest and perhaps even for humanitarian reasons, the idea of people coming across the Mediterranean, across the Channel, both offends people's idea that borders should have at least some degree of control, and also, is just a sort of visible image of government failure to manage migration at all. So you have this slightly contradictory thing where, you have governments in both continental Europe and the UK introducing policies which are de facto designed to encourage regular migration, at the same time as saying to their public, "We're very strongly anti-immigration. We don't want immigration, and here you are. We're sending people to Rwanda, or in the case of European governments, literally drowning people in the Mediterranean." Or paying the Tunisians or the Libyans to drown people as an attempt to deter them from coming here irregularly. Even though in many cases these, under slightly different circumstances, they might be some of the people who are coming might be the same people. That does not seem to me to be, even leaving aside the sort of humanitarian aspects of it. The sort of political contradictions of that seem to me to be quite difficult to manage over the medium to long term, which is why I think there's a fairly general consensus among migration specialists that you need to manage this better. You need to have a sort of more positive approach to migration, particularly migration for work, as a way of managing and reducing, if not eliminating, irregular and illegal flows, much better than we do now and in a more humanitarian way. But at the moment, we're a long way from that. And of course, the political dynamics in much of Europe are do not favor that. As I say, you point to the contradictions in the UK, just, the UK approach, which are absolutely, that's absolutely right. But some European countries are even worse. You have Italy, where you have a far right government, or a government with large elements from the far right, which is in some respects quite is attempting to take as an extremely hard line on irregular migration, with extremely unpleasant and sometimes racist rhetoric. And yet at the same time, it is not exactly, it's an open secret in Italian politics that large scale irregular migration of people who then work on low wages irregularly in factories and farms is welcomed by a lot of the people who, frankly, support, bankroll, or even are represented in those very right-wing parties that are currently in government. So, the degree of internal contradictions there, and of course, it's not dissimilar in the US too, right? Where again, irregular migration has for a very long term served the interests of various people in the businesses, small and large, at the same time as politicians complain about it. So how we resolve those contradictions without ending up in a very dangerous place politically, I think, is a big challenge.
In your excellent book, written, I guess, probably in the middle of the disastrous, laughable British negotiations for withdrawal from the European Union, what do we know and what should we do about immigration? You draw on Adam Smith's notion of the division of labor, kind of global division of labor, as a potentially useful way of seeing the satisfaction of demand and supply norms to create an equilibrium, and how this can apply in immigration terms. You know, the idea that a person arriving and taking a job is not taking a job necessarily from a Briton in this instance, because they're going to be creating more labor demand as a consequence of buying things and paying taxes and meeting people, wandering around, right? They're going to engage in economic activity, which itself will stimulate employment. But you also talk about the fact that one cannot have a market as the high priest or priestess of all and sundry, and that social relations need to be addressed as part of any immigration policy. One of the, in your wonderful capsule history of immigration to Britain, where you prove that it is a country of immigrants, and it always has been. You have a focus at one point on Jewish immigration and how it has, you know, currently not that big an issue, but has been through waves of incitement to come and then expulsion or rejection, anti-Semitic feeling. And whilst I know that you're focused on empirical economics, it does seem as though these social and sometimes religious and racial questions can overdetermine the logic of how a labor market can function. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And again, I mean, the UK is a sort of particularly interesting case study in this, especially, you know, because you know, to the extent that Brexit was driven by immigration, you know, the vote to Brexit was driven by feelings about immigration. And I don't think there's any doubt that it was, at least in the sort of fairly narrow sense that when you have a, you know, a 52-48 vote, that lots of things make that extra margin. But to the extent that one substantive issue drove the vote to Brexit, it was immigration. And you could see that in the campaign with the Remain campaign's unwillingness to actually defend the impact of the of EU membership on immigration. It largely avoided the issue because it felt that was a losing gamble. But the interesting thing, of course, was the sort of contradictions in within that anti-immigration view and anti-immigration vote, right? In the sense that some of the people who voted for Brexit actually favored, you know, were from the sort of libertarian end of the spectrum on economics, and actually largely favored, like, you know, once Liz Truss favored a relatively liberal immigration policy. Others didn't, you know, thought that the issue was the UK's control over immigration, in particular the fact that we could not reduce the number of Europeans coming here. Others, somewhat irrationally, but nonetheless, you know, something that parts of the Leave campaign at least deliberately appealed to, were simply xenophobic and didn't like immigrants, especially non-white immigrants, even though, of course, EU membership was not really had very, very little to do with immigration from outside the EU. So you have this sort of slightly bizarre coalition of people whose view, you know, with you know, of people who were worried about immigration, but actually had quite different views on what the problem was and what should be done about it. And so we see that now, where actually we've had this immigration from within the EU has dropped essentially to zero, but we have a huge new we have a very large levels of immigration from, in particular, India, Nigeria, some other sub-Saharan African countries, some other South Asian countries. And again, you have a very different set of reactions to this. I can see it, among people who support Brexit. Some people are saying, well, this is fine. This just shows we can choose who we want. We have a system that allows people in from anywhere in the world if they meet our criteria. Other people who are saying, I didn't vote for Brexit to be overrun by Nigerians or whatever, and there are fairly thinly disguised xenophobic or racist motivations there very often. So you have this. It's not as that the public attitudes to immigration are very far from being as simple as, well, on the one hand, you have a bunch of sort of liberal, progressive, open borders types who want to let everyone in, and on the other hand, you have a bunch of knuckle-dragging, Brexit-supporting racists. Of course, those view, there is a small minority of people in each of those categories, but actually, the nature of the way immigration has influenced British society over the past 30 or 40 years in particular is that the vast majority of people have much, much more complex views over immigration in both immigration in general and about different nationalities, cultural groups, and how they've impacted the UK either nationally or locally.
One of the things that strikes me about Britain, if I go back to the 70s and the Marxist immigrant slogan, "We are here because you were there," is that part of this issue is not really coming to terms with the legacy of empire. There's an old Nigerian saying, when the white man came, we had the land and they had the Bible. When he left, he had the land and we had the Bible. Slogans can be very appealing, for example, take back control. But it seems as though there remains this huge cultural issue about what to do with the legacy of imperialism and the legacy of slavery and their role in dynamizing the British economy in the early 19th century, especially. Because there are some opinion polls that show some kind of correlation between a pride in empire and a belief that it enabled better lives for other people from the countries that were brought into the empire and voting for Brexit. I mean, I take your point about it's not just sort of knuckle-headed people whose hands drag on the ground when they walk that vote for Brexit. But there is something there about a reckoning with empire, isn't there?
There may be again. I tend to think that for the sort of countervailing, not contradictory, sort of analysis of this is the sort of view that the I forgot who said it, but the British acquired the empire in a fit of absent-mindedness, largely by accident, as it were, or more rigorously, that is to say that much of of course our acquisition of empire, particularly in India, was driven by economic motivations and imperialist exploitation, but that was nonetheless still only a peripheral part of the UK economy. That is to say, it was particular sectional interests and sectors which drove it, and that it wasn't as fundamental to the development of the UK as others argue. So, you can put this down. In terms of how it affects psychology today, again, I mean, I think there are those on both sort of extremes. There are people who think we still haven't come to terms with empire. We still haven't reckoned for our role in first slavery and then imperialism. And there are other people on the other side who want to try and defend that and say, well, actually, the sort of, well, actually, we abolished slavery first, or well, actually, we built the railways in India. I have very, very little time for the second group there. But on the other hand, while I think that the sort of the first is important from a historical and analytic perspective, I'm not sure it's a main driver of public opinion either here or among in the countries that that most immigrants to the UK come from. I was in India a couple of weeks ago, and I gave a talk about the current, very rapid growth in UK, India, in migration from India to the UK, which has been quite extraordinary over the last couple of years. I do not get the impression that there clearly is a cultural and historical connection between us and India, most notably observable in shared language and to some extent the recognizably commonality among institutions and a bit of culture, and all that, of course, promotes that flow. And is one of the reasons, for example, that Indians want to come to UK universities and so on. But I don't get the impression that young Indians looking to move here to work or study think about the historic connotations of empire as such. In other words, they don't think we're here because you were there, in the way that people in the who came here in the 1950s or 60s from Jamaica or India or Pakistan very clearly were. Those groups did. They are here, and their descendants are here because we were there. And historically, there's no doubt about that. But I'm not sure that that is how Indians and Nigerians who are coming here, which are together constitute up to half of all the people coming here at the moment. I don't sense that on the whole that they're angry, that they care, that they may or may not be interested in the colonial history and the rest of it, but I don't see it. They see it. They think they see it as a primary driver of current migration flows or the reason why they want to come to the UK.
Point taken. John Robert Seeley is the guy who said the British acquired an empire, and a bit of absent-mindedness, by the way. Yes, and of course, there's a class difference because so many people, Sikhs and others coming in the 50s and 60s, were in Britain to do things like work on the buses and so on. Whereas a lot of people nowadays coming to study and many coming to work in the National Health Service may be either very highly qualified people or from working class origins, but who have studied and, are in the kind of lower middle class in sectoral terms. And of course, one element in this too is the problem of the National Health Service and problems that British agriculture is confronting as well in the context of Brexit. But Brexit doesn't explain this huge migration of the last few years that you mentioned. How do you account for that, other than or including things like NHS needs for staff?
I mean, it really is a sort of a perfect storm, as it were, of things. It was a combination and Brexit did have an impact, both in reducing the number of Europeans here, which in turn created gaps, and in, there was a sort of political economy explanation in that even before Brexit happened, there was a sharp fall in the number of Europeans. That led to labour market pressures. The government, when considering how to what the post-Brexit migration system should look like, was very much worried both by what businesses were saying about the labor shortages and thinking also, well, we want Brexit to be a success. We don't want obvious problems to be directly attributable to Brexit, therefore, we better err on the side of having a relatively liberal immigration system to smooth the transition, and ended up sort of overcorrecting in the other direction. So there you have that on the Brexit side, and then on the then of course you had the pandemic and the opening up after the pandemic, where you saw labour shortages in a number of sectors in a number of countries, right? With the UK particularly badly affected, but. This was a sort of common phenomenon that health and care systems found they had large shortages in most countries, aggravated in the UK by the underfunding of the NHS and the care system, and even more than underfunding in the NHS, the sort of general burnout and feeling that the government wasn't treating people very well. So you have this situation where British people or people who were already employed in the NHS were, because of a combination of what they perceived to be poor conditions, lower pay, and actually high labor demand and rising wages in sectors outside the health and care sector where they thought they could earn as much or more money for with less pain, leaving, and a government desperate that the deterioration in the health and care system shouldn't accelerate even further, and therefore liberalizing the immigration system. So all that combined led to where we are now. And then at the same time, you have a set of things happening in the university sector where the government, again, for financial reasons or political stroke financial reasons, is underfunding the part of the system that funds UK students. Because it doesn't want to put in taxpayers' money or to remedy that or to increase the tuition fees that domestic students have to pay, the obvious source of funds was increased fees from foreign students. So the government took a positive decision to try and get the sector to recruit many more foreign students. And the sector responded by doing what it was told and heavily incentivized to do. But that, of course, means more part of that was allowing students to stay on for a couple of years after they finished their studies and work. So you have this sort of interaction of the student visa system with the immigration system more broadly, which again has pushed up the numbers quite significantly.
Well, that's a wonderful explanation. Thank you. I wondered if I could ask you a couple of personal questions. One is more professional, one slightly personal. You mentioned in the book that I was referring to, What We Know and What We Do About Immigration, that you're the child of immigrants. And I wondered if you'd be prepared to talk a little bit about what that was like. Did they sound different from other people's parents? You have a last name that's different from a sort of classic English last name. What was that like as a child growing up? And if you by all means answer with a guttural, it was okay. But if there's more to say, then please tell us.
I mean, obviously, I'm from a privileged background, right? My father was a Rhodes Scholar, so my parents came here as students, one way or another ended up liking it here and staying. They moved back briefly to the US, but very briefly, and eventually decided that they really preferred it here. One thing that does do for me is that I'm always, when people say, oh, people are using students as a backdoor to immigration here, students are fine, we should make sure we kick them out when they leave. And I sort of say, well, life doesn't work that like that, and either society doesn't work like that, either economically or socially or personally. And actually, if you want to have an open society and a successful economy, you need to allow for the fact that people will make decisions or changes. And actually, most students will indeed go back, or some will stay. My parents did stay. They didn't plan to stay. It wasn't they came here saying, oh, we're going to use this as a backdoor to the British immigration system. They came here because my father won a scholarship and they ended up staying. And that's worked out pretty well for them and pretty well for the UK, at least in purely economic and financial terms. When I was growing up, I did have an accent. I still have an accent, as for reasons which no one really understands. My sister, similar position, obviously, does not have an accent. She sounds as British as anyone else brought up in North London. But for whatever reason, I've always been slightly identifiable as not quite from here. I certainly wouldn't say that's caused me any problems. Because I'm white and from an upper middle class professional background, and in the end, that matters far more. But it's always been noticeable, and I've always sort of been aware of that. I'm Jewish as well, of course, again, that's never been a problem for me. But again, it's something that I am definitely not. An English person of whose parents have and grandparents, great grandparents have been here for hundreds of years. So in that sense, I don't think I'd have never it's never been problematic. It hasn't inhibited my career or my profession. But on the other hand, it certainly shaped my identity and attitudes to some extent. And I think, I do, and I do say that. I say that, as I said in the book, and as I said to say, I say to my students, look, I'm an economist. I'm primarily an empirical economist, and I'm going to be teaching you some stuff about the economics and empirics of immigration. But this is an inherently small p political subject, and we shouldn't pretend, none of us should pretend we come at it entirely objectively, because of course our subjective and personal experiences shape our attitudes here.
And speaking of that, and this is, I promise, the last personal question I'll ask. Much of your career was spent in the civil service as an economist, working in cognate fields. What are some of the differences and similarities between doing that as a person giving policy advice and being a prof?
I think it is. It's completely different. As a civil servant, you are, you have to do it properly to largely internalize the objectives of your ministers, in order to do what civil servants are supposed to do, which is to provide sound, objective analysis. Where necessary, speak truth to power, all those cliches. But you can't do that properly unless you've internalized what the ministers are actually trying to achieve. Your job is to, if the minister says, our objective is to reduce child poverty, or our objective is to increase investment in this particular sector, or our objective is to ensure that we retain monetary sovereignty and don't, rather than do, those are legitimate objectives set by democratically elected governments and ministers. And your job is to then, of course, you approve, and you really have to be able to internalize those to then be able to say to minister, well, this is, I think this is the right way of achieving that objective. Or I think, if you actually want to say to a minister, you're doing this wrong, or here's a better way, you actually have to be able to convincingly say to them that this is a better way to achieve your objective, not to achieve my objective or mine, or to, to be a good civil servant, you really have to be able to do that and to do it consistently and convincingly. And then, of course, the second thing, of course, is that at least in the way we the civil service works now, that is done internally. You don't, you know, you don't. It's not. It is an internal debate, not a public debate. You may get input and information from external sources, and if you're doing it properly, you will. But nonetheless, the decisions are taken internally, and you don't go out and argue your own case for a particular approach against other civil servants, let alone the minister. That's the way the UK system works, and it has its advantages and disadvantages. But for better or worse, it is the way the UK system works. And as long as we're going to continue with something broadly along those lines, civil servants have to broadly play by those rules, and ministers indeed have to broadly play by those rules. Whereas from as a external researcher and academic, I can say what I like pretty much, and I can say, but what I like both in terms of saying what I think the facts, evidence, and analysis show, and also what I say, what I like in terms of my own personal and political views about what should happen, as opposed to what the evidence says. And I do both. So there, I think that the challenge for, and this is a challenge for academics in the public debate generally, is to And it goes back slightly to what I said earlier about, you can't, about immigration and how I present to my students. It's a spectrum, right? On the one hand, I personally am in favor of a relatively open liberal migration policy. I think that's good for the country. I think it's good socially and politically, morally, as well as economically. That's a political view. People that it's not one that you can disagree with. Well, it's one you can disagree with. You can't say, you can't think that because the evidence doesn't support it. You can say you disagree with it because you have a different political and social view. And so there's that sort of opinion, and then there's the sort of opinion which is, well, my reading of the academic and empirical evidence is that there is very little to no evidence that immigration has any significant negative impact on employment probabilities for natives in the UK. That is an empirical finding, which I believe is pretty strongly supported by the literature. And I will teach that to my students as this is what the academic and it's what the consensus says. So that so those are two same topic, but two opposite ends of the spectrum. So when I'm talking about this stuff in public, you have to be sort of you have some duty at least to say when you're saying making a statement of the first type, I think the Rwanda scheme is immoral. To making a statement of the second type, I'm pretty sure the Rwanda scheme won't work even on its own terms. And then there are a bunch of gray areas in the middle. And I think that, that's quite hard. And I don't lot, I don't always get it right. Lots of other academics don't always get it right because it's quite hard. You have some duty at least to try and convey when you are saying something, as a expert. Or an academic, you have some duty to try and convey when something is your own personal view, when it is something that you think emerges out of your or others' research as as an analytic proposition, and when actually sometimes it's a mix of both, as it sometimes is.
And Prof, I've got a couple more questions, and then to conclude, I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed. Does that sound all right, a good
Sure.
way of drawing things to a close? So my first question is this: potted history, post-war in the global north, there's a Keynesian consensus, more or less, about how to use demand and taxation to ensure full employment. That seems to collapse when suddenly you get inflation and unemployment together. You get a movement towards a neoclassical slash neoliberal model of economics with deregulation as the mantra. 2008 happens, and you were principally involved in saving the world, to use Gordon Brown's modest description of his work. And then suddenly people go back to Keynesianism. Now, I realize this is very crude, but I think it's roughly true. In all of that, we're now in a situation where the British economy is really in the toilet, as far as I can see, in a variety of ways. The finance sector that was so central to the world and especially to Europe has declined. The growth is poor. There have been years of high inflation, now somewhat under control, but still the effects are felt. Productivity is not great, and so on. And it seems as though there is a need for massive stimulus of demand, growth, and also industrial development by the state, even as indebtedness by the government is high. Even as there is a call for lessening taxation, even as taxation is at historic levels. To quote Lenin, what is to be done?
Well, I mean, I think you've just given a very good summary of what in a recent report that I and others wrote for UK and Children's Europe, I described as the sort of a doom loop, which is that the view that on the one hand things are so bad that we can't possibly go on like this. It's all just terrible. And we have to make a radical change. And on the other, the constraints, in particular, the fact that we have very high debt and a large, still a large deficit and so on, mean that there's nothing we can do and we're just doomed. And that's what we describe as doom. And I think, that is at least somewhat overblown on both counts. I mean, first of all, the UK economy has indeed performed quite poorly over the last 15 years, as have other European economies. And that is due to a combination of things, some long-standing problems, but also austerity and then Brexit. But nonetheless, we're still a very rich, advanced country. We have some, we have lots of successful sectors and so on. So, for example, UK service exports have grown faster than almost any other country over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years because we're very good at things like not just finance, but accountancy, business services, consultancy, advertising, law, and so on. And pretty much everybody thinks that, service trade will continue to grow much faster than goods trade. And so we're lucky. We're doing the things that actually the world is likely to want to buy in the next over the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Similarly, higher education, so UK higher education is a success story. The government is doing its best to blow it up now, but that doesn't, there's no, that is not inevitable. You can, our the fundamental strength of the sector is quite strong. We just have to do some things which will be difficult, but by no means impossible. Similarly, increasing investment and and here again, I sort of throw it back in the sense that things are so bad that that in turn means that there is no reason that they can't get quite a lot better. That is to say, we've built so few houses. We're so bad at building infrastructure compared, actually, not just to the US, but actually to lots of, in this case, to lots of other European countries that do it much better than us. We don't need, as it were, to come up with some great we don't need to be on the leading edge. We don't need to reinvent, to invent some wonderful new way of building houses or building roads, or building railways, or reforming the planning system. We simply need to raise ourselves up to what other countries do reasonably well. And we would be a substantially richer and more prosperous country over the medium term. So there is, are plenty we can do. On tax, again, we're not that highly taxed by European standards or even by other standards of other advanced economies outside Europe. We are taxed quite badly. We've allowed the tax system to become extremely complicated, opaque, and to have some very odd bits of it that create disincentives to doing sensible things. So you could raise more money without, sort of raising the economic burden of tax by on the country as a whole by that much if you have the political will to enact, again, fairly simple reforms. Every other country in the world, pretty every other advanced economy actually has a property tax. We don't have a property tax. We have effectively something which is in between a what used to be rates and a poll and the poll tax. That's an entirely self-inflicted wound. Which again, where pretty much every economist will tell you it's not that difficult to make a reform which would raise more money, increase economic efficiency, be progressive, encourage more houses to be built, and all the rest of it. So there are plenty of things that we can do if we can get our politics right. Now, that is by no means inevitable. I mean, what you could say, unfortunately, you could say have said, could say, and could have said 10 or 20 years ago, much the same about Italy. Lots of inherent advantages and quick wins, and the Italians have not taken them because their politics is dysfunctional. And so there's no, the fact that we could be in a lot better place doesn't mean we will be. We could do what the Italians do and continue to elect governments who are for either willfully or just by incompetence and dis, you know, don't actually do any of these things. But it's not by any means inevitable. We don't have to resign ourselves to this.
Well, I know Rachel Reeves is a regular listener to this podcast, so no doubt you probably already have her ear. But let's hope that her rhetoric is not a sign of what she will do. But as you say, there are ways in which actually government could be run very effectively if it altered its priorities. And there are lots of things that could be done that would not cost huge amounts of money and might even bring in large amounts of money if Keir Starmer and his cohort can forget about the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, the Daily Telegraph, and other organs of the far right. So, last question, Prof, if I may, before throwing to you, which is to ask, I'm a 24-year-old. I've come to King's. I've gotten my honours degree. I'm knocking on your door saying, Prof P, I want to do a doctorate. What should I study and what should I be when I grow up?
I mean, I think the first thing I would say is, if you want to change the world, that's not a reason for not doing a doctorate, but don't do it yet. Go and work. Go out into, I joined the civil service immediately after my undergraduate degree, and I didn't do my advanced degree until later. I would say, you won't know what you want to do your doctorate on, what you really want to get into, until you've had some experience with actually dealing with things in, like distinction between the university and the real world, but not just doing research, but actually doing practice, doing business, doing policy, doing public advocacy, doing whatever that is. So I'd say go and do that, and then you will find it is that what it is that you're really, really w want to focus on. So that would be the first thing I would say, actually, is to say you will come to that. I came to immigration as a topic when I was in my early 30s, as it happens. And purely by chance, because it happened to be something that I was working on peripherally in government, and then something that I decided I wanted to, that I persuaded my superiors that needed to be done in more depth. But it wasn't because, and I had absolutely no idea at the age of 21 what I was interested in or what I wanted to do beyond the sort of general sense that I wanted to do something in public policy one way or another. So that I think that's what I would say. I would say, if you want detailed advice, if you want to be an academic and research in a particular area, then go and talk to somebody whose background is much, much more research focused than my, has had much more of a completely research focused career than mine on how you actually structure a research career. But if, and I think this is true of the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of my students, if you really want to, don't know exactly what you want to do, but you do feel you want to change the world in some way, then I would say go out and try it at the bottom first, and then you will find out what it is you really want to do.
I think that's great advice. So, Prof, to conclude, I'm wondering if there are things we haven't touched on that you'd like to mention, or things we did discuss where you'd want to add something.
I mean, I think I will come back to what you said before about the future of the UK. I mean, it is in some ways, when I think back to the early to mid 2000s, things did seem a lot easier in the sense if both for the country as a whole and for policy, we had what appeared to be a reasonably stable, we had arrived at a sort of post-Thatcher, post-Keynes consensus in the UK that, you had a moderately neoliberal approach to managing the economy and a moderately social democratic approach to redistribution and poverty. And that seemed to be something, and that seemed to be a sort of viable future for the UK of reasonably steady growth and a reasonably progressive approach to the welfare state and public services. And that broke down domestically and internationally with the 2008 crisis. And contrary to the expectation, it broke down. And then, as you said, it was never restored. Some people thought it might be restored. I thought it might be restored, but it wasn't. The last few years, of course, have seen even further disintegration, both economically and geopolitically. So it is not, that the national and international environment is far less benign than it seemed to us 20 years ago. I guess my I wish I knew what the answers are, but I do think I know that, we cannot be fatalistic about this. We have to return to having some sort of ambitious, optimistic vision of the future of this country that doesn't involve millions of children being in poverty, people sleeping on the streets, a disintegrating public realm from the NHS to the criminal justice system and so on. It does not have to be this way. And I don't think we need some sort of huge intellectual or economic revolution to change that, but we will need to work quite hard. And we will need politicians and civil servants and academics and business people and so on who actually have a degree of courage and are prepared to take some difficult decisions to turn it around.
Jonathan Portes, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.